It's all about God. The Psalms are all about God, and believe it or not, they're actually to God. Some of them, they are a deep pleas, and right as the writers cry out. Some of them are about struggles and disconnection that we experience with sin. Others are praises for the God, and who He is. And so others, they're just designed to leave us pondering about who is God. Amazingly, God is there to listen to all of these. Not passively, but actively. And well, this brings us back to a thought about what all of the Psalms are really about. They're all about this thing that we like to call worship. And that sort of makes sense. And maybe this is a good week that we had to take a moment to sit down and talk about what is communion. Maybe we should have more, I guess, instructional moments when we talk about this thing called worship. Or should we? Is worship really designed to be as complicated sometimes as we make it out to be? I mean, like I said, we're supporting two worship services right now, and sometimes that gets a touch bit on the complicated side. I'm asking Matt, as he's looking at a headset on and a headset off, and he's trying to adjust this dial and that dial, or when Kayla's back there, and they're trying to make all of this work together, and because we want to do a good worship service. But let us remember, a worship service is not the same thing as worship. A worship service should be designed to lead us to worship. The service itself is not worship. And thus, not all of worship is feel-good moments. Some of it, honestly, can be quite convicting and just a little bit intense. Worship is not a pep rally. I am absolutely positively not sure who came up with the idea that the idea behind worship is I'm supposed to go away with a bunch of warm fuzzies. But obviously, if that's your thought of worship, you've never taken your time to read through the book of Psalms. It's also important to remember that while I receive benefit from worship, I am not the beneficiary of worship. I come here and we sing. Most of you know how we do services around here. I write sermons weeks, months in advance. I give them to the worship team. The worship team looks them through. They pick music that will go with the sermon so that when it comes together, it's not about the style of music. It's about the message of music. Sometimes, like this morning, I'm sitting there and, you know, I put the slides together and I don't really think that much about the words. And so the first time I'm hearing some of these songs, because I grew up in a church that we didn't do a lot of hymns. Okay, and so some of these songs, the first time I hear them is sitting here on Sunday morning, and I hear them to music, and it's interesting as I listen to song after song, and I'm listening to my sermon unfold in music. That's worship. God is putting one thing on top of the other, and at the end of all of this, I do get benefit from being here, but I'm not the beneficiary. I am not what's supposed to be brought forward. I mean, remember, what's the old saying that they have? It's not about the song I sing. It's about the heart I bring. I can come here and sing magnificent. Okay, I can't sing magnificent songs because I can't sing a lick. Okay, but we can come here and we can sing magnificent songs, but if all I did was bring God a song, it's not worship. Now, there's nothing wrong with me liking worship or enjoying a music style, a sermon, or even the seat that I sit in. But the very moment that becomes my primary focus, guess what? It's worship, but now I'm worshiping me. I'm not worshiping the person that I came into this presence to worship. So that means we have to understand the reality of it all. We should be able to change anything and everything about worship except for whom we are worshiping. And it shouldn't matter one bit. As long as my worship is directed toward that. And this is not a fuss fest or a scolding or a let's get it right. It's because sometimes we, not you, not I, we just need a reminder. And the good news is, as you listen to the Psalm 19 being sung to you, hopefully that started the thought process, because today we're going to get into Psalm 19, and it starts out by describing the glory of God in nature. But this is kind of a schizophrenic psalm. We're going to call it maybe even a Jekyll and Hyde, because while it starts out talking about nature, if you were listening to the song as it was sung to you, it then goes into some description and the importance of the law of God. And it seems like an odd transition. In fact, some people even think that maybe these two things were two separate poems that were kind of smooshed together in one book. But they're not. This psalm is not about nature, and it's not about the law. It's about God. You know, and how he speaks to us, and I am popping just a little bit, so I'm going to go down just a little bit, Matt, okay? So hopefully that doesn't affect online too much. So it is about law, and it's about how, I mean, it's about God, and it's about how he reveals himself both to us and in us. Okay, we're having all kind of, there we go. In the 18th century, philosopher Immanuel Kant once said, two things fill the mind with ever new increasing admiration and awe, the starry heavens above and the moral laws within. I can stand out at night and see the beautiful skies and all the stars. I guess it was about a week or so ago, we had one of those great big Waynesboro thunder boomers, and it came through and it pulled out so quick. And we looked up, and at the end of our street, you know it was there, right? Beautiful double rainbow. How can you not look at those things and think, wow, God's in control of it all? And sometimes I can look in my life, and I'm trying to figure things out, and it just is way too complicated. But I need to understand that in everything I look and see and do, we need to see God. I look around, and we look within ourselves, and we see not just how we want to act, we also see how I should act. There's always that little voice inside of you that says, this is a bad thing to do. Unfortunately, we begin to not think about the things that we should do. So today's Psalms combines these two things and shows us what we're supposed to do about what we see in the heavens and what we feel in our heart. The reason these two things move us so much is they are the ways that God reveals himself to us. Through nature and the law, we hear God's calling, and we make our choices and how we are going to respond to that calling. So this is a really simple message, folks. Today we're discussing declaring God's glory. We're going to be in Psalm chapter 19, so if you brought a Bible with you, you can go ahead and grab that and pull it out and turn to Psalm 19. That's where we're going to be. And we're just going to kind of walk through the psalmist's words as he talks about declaring God's heaven. And again, he starts in nature. The heavens declare the glory of God, and the skies proclaim the work of his hand. Day after day they pour forth speech. They pour forth speech. Night after night they reveal knowledge. They have no speech. They use no words, no sounds is heard from them. Yet their voice goes out into all the earth, their words to the ends of the world. In the heaven, God has pitched a tent for the sun. It is like a bridegroom coming out of his chamber, like a champion rejoicing to the run of his course. It rises at one end of the heavens and makes its circuit to another. Nothing is deprived from its warmth. The psalmist wants to make sure we understand all creation testifies to us that there is a God. It's a constant testimony. Day after day, they pour forth their speech, and night after night, they reveal their knowledge. There is no time of day that you can go out and look at nature and not see God's handiwork. But not only is it constant, it's kind of silent. I'm getting ready to celebrate my 57th birthday. Yeah, I'm old. I get it. I'm old. But I'm getting ready to celebrate my 57th birthday, and not once in my 57 years have I ever had an animal come up and testify to me about God. No speaking to them. I've never had a rock cry out to me. I've never met a tree out in the woods that talks to me, and I am thankful for all of these things because that's not how the world is supposed to look, unless it's a Disney universe, right? Everything can talk in a Disney universe, but in reality, not everything can talk. Therefore, sometimes we just have to pay attention because when we look at nature, it is idea without words. We can look at the things in nature and we can get the idea that all of this had to come from somewhere. I don't care who you are, you don't believe that this has always been here. Somewhere, somehow, this had to come into existence. And this idea that it can speak but not speak, I know that might seem a little contradictory, but the point is it's not going to intrude on us. This testimony from nature is not something that God put in place that is going to come in and it's going to look at you. And it's going to talk to you. And it's going to force you to look at it. It is absolutely positively not like a person shouting to get our attention. This is God speaking. And oftentimes, God speaks in quiet whispers. Just ask our good friend Job, Job chapter 26, verse 14. And these are but the outer fringe of his works. How faint the whispers we hear of him. Who then can understand the thunder of his power? And since God does speak in a whisper, if you're not paying attention, you just might miss it. Just ask the prophet Elijah, 1 Kings chapter 19, verses 11 through 12. The Lord said, go out and stand on the mountain in the presence of the Lord. The Lord is about to pass by. Then a great and powerful wind tore the mountain apart and shattered the rocks before the Lord. But the Lord was not in the wind. And after the wind, there was an earthquake. But the Lord was not in the earthquake. And after the earthquake came a fire. But the Lord was not in the fire. And after the fire came a gentle whisper. As God approached. We go and we chat with our friend Paul, who we spend a lot of time, especially on this verse, talking about, especially when you're in the psalm. Understand that if you take notice, you will absolutely see the glory of God in our nature. For since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his inner and his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that people without excuse. Clearly seen. I don't have to guess. It's not a puzzle. I should be able to go out and look at nature and I can see God. And some of the things that I see makes me feel really, really good. Because if you're looking, you will find the proof in nature and the greatness of God because everything is where it belongs. As a person that struggles with OCD at times, I have a huge problem when things aren't where they're supposed to be. You know, when I'm sitting there at the television, I'm looking at the television, we have a mantle in front of our television, and you know what? There are things sitting on the mantle. If it's unbalanced and it's not symmetrical, it drives me crazy. I mean, I really have to, something's got to move because everything needs to be in its place. And well, that's kind of what God says. God put everything in its place. The next section of this particular song, it focuses on the sun. And you know the sun is exactly where it's supposed to be? It's perfectly aligned with where it needs to be. It says that the heavens God has pitched a tent for the sun. So the sun is exactly where it's supposed to be. I have one of those moments. There we go. But there are two things that you need to notice about the sun. The sun has a job to do, does it not? Anybody ever here woken up and the sun wasn't doing its job? Maybe we can't see it because it's a cloudy day, but you do understand the sun is always doing its job. How do we know the sun is doing its job? We can feel it's warm. Also, we're not hurling off through space. You get it. Without the sun, that would disrupt everything, and we would be a comet. Trying to live on a comet wouldn't be a very fun thing. So everything is absolutely positively where it's supposed to be. It has a job to do. But I love the way the psalmist talks about it. It is joy in what it is doing. It's like a bridegroom coming out of his chamber. If you've ever been to a wedding and you're at that moment, the bride hasn't entered yet, the doors are still shut, and kind of sheepishly the groom and the best man and the minister, they kind of scuttle in right here. But if you look at the bridegroom, he has such anticipation for what's about to happen. Because he knows in just a few moments, that door is going to open. And the person that he's going to spend the rest of his life is going to be standing back there. And I want to tell you something. She took extra time to get ready that morning. Man, her hair, there isn't a hair out of place, and her makeup is perfect, and she's got on this dress, and she is so ready, and he's excited. Why? Because not only is he where he's supposed to be, at least he better be, or he's going to be in a lot of trouble when that door opens and he ain't there. He's where he's supposed to be, but he has joy in what he's about doing. It's like a person that runs a race. When they finish, they're celebrating because they have run their course. He creates everything for purpose. He puts each part of his creation where it can do good and what it was made to do and where it can take joy in being what it was made to be. And with that, our psalmist switches gears and he takes us to verses 7 through 13 and he begins to talk about God's word. The law of the Lord is perfect, refreshing the soul. The statutes of the Lord are trustworthy, making wise the simple. The precepts of the Lord are right and giving joy to the heart. And the commands of the Lord are radiant, given to the eyes. The fear of the Lord is pure, enduring forever. The decrees of the Lord are firm, and all of them are righteousness. They are more precious than gold, more pure than gold. They are sweeter than honey, and honey from the honeycomb. By them your servants are warned in keeping them and keeping their great reward. But who can discern their own errors? Forgive my hidden faults. Keep your servant also from willful sins. May they rule over me, then I will be blameless and innocent of great transgressions. As we talk about what finds joy, the sun seems to be able to find its place. The moon seems to be able to find its place. We're about to be at that time of season where we're going to see the birds start flying to their place, and they'll be back. But as I walk across creation, you know what the one thing that seems to just never be able to find its space? It's us. We seem to be unable to find our joy. And that's why Psalms moves from nature to word. Because quite frankly, since I am one, I get to say this. There is something wrong with mankind. We're broken and rebellious. Aren't we? God tells us to do something. We're like, really? I can find a better way to do that, or at least another way to do that. We need something more. I look at it here at the testimony of nature, and you know what? I start making up other stories of how this all got here, right? I can explain it all away because I need something more. And God said, yeah, I'm going to give you something more. We need the law of God to heal our brokenness and, well, to correct our rebellion. So the psalmist shifts abruptly from discussing the importance of the law to discussing the importance of the law of God. And, well, It includes them, but it's more generally a reference that the will and guidance of God is contained in Scripture. So when we usually think law, what do we think? We think the Bible, right? We think Ten Commandments from Moses, all the thou shalt nots and all the thou shalls, all the things that Jesus told us, and that's all law. But you do understand the law isn't just about written words, it's about the will of God. Therefore, the author sort of proceeds here in the next few verses to discuss the transformational potential. What am I going to get out of studying the law? You know, sometimes we say that we're a Bible study and we're thinking, oh my gosh, have you read that stuff? I could read some of this, and especially when you get to all the begats and all the names there, and I lose something. I can't find it. So let's talk about what the law is supposed to do. How is it supposed to fix my brokenness and my rebelliousness? Really simple. It says the law restores. The law of the Lord is perfect and refreshing the soul. Remember, you're a four-part person. Okay? There is the physical you. That's the part of you I see. The part that I look at in the mirror and think, yeah, it really is getting old. All right? So there's my physical part. There is my mental part, those things that I think. There is my emotional part, those things that I feel. And then there's that spiritual part. That's the part that's really broken. It's my soul. The law of God is not an arbitrary or external set of rules. It's intended to not ruin our lives, but to help our lives. It's an owner's manual written by the Maker, showing us how to operate the human machine. You ever gotten one of those things? You went out and you bought it at the store, and you took it out the box, and you looked at it, and you're like, I got this. I know how to do this. And so what do you do with the owner's manual? You chuck it in the trash, and then when it doesn't work the way that it's supposed to work, you're like, you're digging back through the trash, and you're thinking, please don't let anybody have dumped the coffee in it or make stains on it. Please make it where I can read this again. You understand when you chuck God's word out of your life, that's exactly what you've done. You're like, God, I got the machine. I know how to run the machine. I know how to do the machine. I know how the machine works. I know how to feed the machine. I got this, God. I'm going to take your law, and I'm going to put it out of my life. The goal of the law is to restore, and restoring us to the purpose and fulfillment and joy that we were made to be. So how does the law restore me? Not real complicated. You see, the law illuminates. The statutes of the Lord are trustworthy, making wise the simple. Because of our sin, we are blind to truth. The purpose of the law is to wake us up to the true nature of things. Intelligence does not produce wisdom. That's a quote from the author that wrote the original. Intelligence does not produce wisdom. I've met some really smart people in my life. They got all the book sense in the universe, but somehow they can't seem to make a ham sandwich. They've got all of the knowledge, but they're not very wise. You know, the thing is that the law can make anybody a wise person. Wisdom comes from hearing and believing the testimony of God about who we are and how we should live. The law does this by enlightening us. It says it's supposed to be a lamp unto our feet, a light unto our path. And if we allow the law to illuminate our life, it says the law protects us. Through God, he can protect us. That's what it says. Verse 11 says, "By them your servant is warned to keep them there, to keep their." Your servant is, I'll say this right, but by them your servant is warned, and keeping them there is great reward. So it puts out a warning there, kind of like when your mom tells you not to touch the stove, right? What do y'all automatically want to do when the mom says don't touch the stove? How hot is hot? Seriously. I mean, you say hot. Hot to you isn't hot to me, right? So we want to touch it, but the law was put there to warn us. It shows us the areas of our lives that we keep messing up on, but we just can't see it. Verse 12 says, "But who can discern their own errors? Forgive my hidden faults." Wow. So I'm not supposed to figure this out all by myself, right? I'm not supposed to come to things and say, you know, that was a bad thing to do. No, it says that the law will tell us what we should and shouldn't do. And when we begin to listen to the law, it frees us from the domination of slavery and sin. So I've got nature, and I've got God's word. But that's not the end of the story, is it? I mean, if that's where the psalm had stopped, everything would be good. But now comes the important part and how it ties back to the idea of worship. Take a look at verse 14. "May these words of my mouth and this meditation of my heart be pleasing in your sight, Lord, my rock and my redeemer." We saw nature. We saw the law. But you know, right there in verse 14, the psalmist asked for his own voice to be added to those things that declare the glory of God. Think about this. The heavens around us, nature, the stars, the sun, the animals, they all declare the law, the Bible, the scripture, the things that we've been taught, they declare. But now may my words and my thoughts also declare the glory of God. That is worship. When you lift your voice and declaring the glory of God, I don't care whether it's a song that we're singing. I don't care if it's a time of communion that we're sharing. I don't care if it's a time of sermon that we are listening. You understand, it's all supposed to point us in the direction of God. The psalmist declares just what he said, not wants to declare not what he just says, but also what he thinks. He wants that to be pleasing to God also. Is it really that important? If I come here and say all the right things, isn't that good enough? Go ahead and keep trying that, because God cares about what we say, because it actually reveals what's in our heart. If you listen to a person long enough, that which is inside of them will come out. If you're not getting there fast enough, you want to know how to get something to come out of somebody, what they really are, go ahead and punch them in the stomach. Whatever they are will come out. If they're full of anger, they're probably going to hit you back. If they're full of forgiveness, they might look at you and say, why did you do that? And they'd be willing to forgive. You understand, what is inside of you will eventually come out. So it isn't just about what I say. The psalmist says, I want my thoughts to be about you. Because God hears our heart even when we try to hide it from others. I can come here on Sunday mornings and I can put on a really good show. I can go and put on some clothes that look kind of churchy. You know, if any of you have seen me out, usually I'm wearing a pair of scrubby shorts and a t-shirt. That's how I dress. So this is dressed up for me. But I can do this. You know what? Come on. Look. I have a smile. Everything is okay in my life, right? Look, I have a smile. I can come here and say things like, praise be the Lord. Blessed is the name of God. Worship Him and Him alone. You understand, I might be able to fool every single person in this room. Make you think I've got it all figured out. And who's the one individual I can't fool? God. I can do it all, but God sees inside of me and He says, you know what? I want to know what's inside of you, and I do know what's inside of you. The psalmist declares to be pleasing to God, not just on the surface, but deep down into the foundations of his, and there's that word again, his soul. God, I want my soul to be open to you. God, my soul is starving for you. God, my soul needs to connect to you. The reason for this was because he views God as his, and I love these words, his rock and his redeemer. That's how he sees God. He knows that there's no stability or security in life apart from God. So if I take God apart, it's like the guy that builds his house on the sand, and when the rains come and the flood rises, what happens to the house? Oh, y'all can do better than that. What happens to the house? There you go, splat. Because the house just cannot stand. But the psalmist says, I'm building my life on a rock. And that rock is God. And that rock, he also knows that beside all the things that we wander off and all the things that we're doing wrong, God had something special in mind when he sent Jesus. He says, he's going to be my redeemer. You know what redemption is, right? So, most of you know, and we've done this analogy before, most of you know that you get a coupon for something off of your groceries, right? And you take that coupon, we'll use Kroger. So you take that coupon to Kroger and you go through Margaret's line and Margaret checks your groceries out and then you hand her your coupons and she scans them and your grocery bill starts coming down, right? You realize that coupon has not been redeemed yet, right? That coupon has been used. So you go home with your groceries. You know when that coupon is redeemed? That was a manufacturer's coupon. So that means eventually the manufacturer is going to come to the store, and they're going to present, the store is going to present all the coupons to the manufacturer, and the manufacturer has to pay the coupon to the store. At that point, the coupon has been redeemed. And that is the picture of what God did for us. God showed himself in nature. God revealed himself in the law. God asked us to reveal him through our worship because he is our redeemer. Something went wrong and I got off the line, and you know what? Now I am back, and God says, I have redeemed you because I came to buy you back. So my question this morning is do you see God? But maybe the better question is, God seen in you.